God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. You have the ability to unmute. You can raise your hand or unmute yourself.
Hey, everybody. My name's Chris, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris. I'm Richard, and I'm an alcoholic.
And we are sharing day 24.
Awesome. Chris and Bridget, welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Everybody should have, everybody has the ability to chat publicly for those who want to pass their numbers on. Is there anybody else in the first 30 days?
I'm Tammy, and I'm an alcoholic, and I have 30 days.
All right, Tammy. Awesome. Is there anybody in the room that just recently picked up 30 days that would like to say hello? Okay. The preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous says that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we are very excited to have Julie L., who's now in Las Vegas, but usually in California. And she'll tell her story. And around the top of the hour, we'll take a short break. We'll call for announcements, pass the seven tradition basket, et cetera. And then for the last half hour of the meeting, we will ask Julie the questions that you submit in the chat. So let's see, I'm going to mute that person. You will see a user in the chat called questions. It's really Larry, but please, as questions occur to you, just use the chat to the user questions, which is really Larry. Okay, makes sense. So I'm really excited for Julie tonight. I got to see her at one of Al J's workshops about 6 weeks back, and was just really grateful that she was able to make the time to come here tonight and tell her story. I give you Julie.
Thank you, Julie Alcoholic.
Hi, Julie.
Appreciate David asking me to speak. I live in California, and I'm here in Vegas for a few days just because I can. And they're not cutting anyone's hair in California, so I want to come and get my hair cut. I know, sad but true. So in one way, I'm kind of grateful for this break because, you know, I've been losing my shirt downstairs. So it's good for me to get a little break and get my priorities right and then come back and get something to eat and slow my roll a little, pun intended. So the accent is Irish. And yes, I was actually born there. I've had people to ask me, you have an accent. And I'm like, yeah, I was speaking, I think, in somewhere in Arizona. I'm not going to say. But they said to me, oh, you have an accent. And I go, I do, yeah. And they go, where are you from? Where is it from? And I said, I'm Irish. And they said, oh, have you ever been? And I'm like, what? Partly try not to be sarcastic because, you know, I was about to speak. So I was like, oh, yeah, I was born there. So I was actually born in Ireland and I come from a big Irish Catholic family. And my mother left my dad when I was about 4 or 5 and we went to London. We went back and forth from London and we lived in some horrible little places. We lived in a building that was like a derelict building. And then we lived in a place where all these Irish construction guys worked downstairs and we lived in the upstairs. And they would share our one bathroom that was in the whole house. And then we got a council property. So, you know, I come from a very rough background, and I always say this. I know now sober that I didn't know this obviously when I was younger, but I come from a house that was a lot of violence, a lot of abuse, but very little discipline. Like, what I mean by that is, like, nobody was paying attention. As long as I didn't bring the police to the door, nobody cared. And so I was able to get away with doing anything I wanted. And that's a bit of a detriment when you first get sober, because there's some certain requirements, you know, some discipline required when you get sober. You know, you attend regular meetings and you show up regularly. And will you show up when you say you're going to show up? And you help put the chair, all that stuff. I didn't know that when I first got sober. And I had to learn those disciplines over the year, because over the years, I just did whatever I felt like. I couldn't care about you, whether you were speaking, whether you weren't. I couldn't care less. Just got up and did my own thing, and had no discipline in me. And I was like that for a long time. So, you know, my first drink, my mother used to smuggle over. We'd travel. My mother never had a driver's license. She was involved in some criminal activity in East End of London. And so she made driver's license. She made her own documents, and she was very good at it. And she never had a driver's license. She was a terrible driver. Was always in accidents with her. And one time she went straight into a police car. It's a whole different story. But anyway, I digress. So we'd come across the border, you know, from Ireland. And she knew this fella in Ireland who made Poutine, which is your guys's moonshine. And I've never had moonshine, but I've drank a lot of Poutine in my time. And my mother knew this fella, and she'd smuggle it, which is totally illegal. She'd smuggle over the poutine to England, and she'd sell it to all the Irish fellas in the pubs, you know. And she used to smuggle it over in, you know, those holy water bottles, you know, the statues of the Blessed Virgin Mary. Well, she'd pour out the holy water, and she'd pour the poutine in, because it's clear. And screw the head back on Mary and put it in the back of the trunk of the car. And as you'd come across over the border with her dodgy license, and he'd pop the trunk, it'd be all these children, like little steps, one after the other. And it's just a woman, not a man in sight, it's just her with these six children. And all these statues of Mary in the back looked like she really needed them. And so they'd let her go. Oh, thanks, sir. Thank you. You know, and we had this drinks cabinet in our house, you know, doesn't everybody. And it was a small drinks cabinet. And my mother was a daily drinker. So she'd go out drinking every day and every evening. And I started to make my way over to drinks cabinet about when I was about 10 years of age. And I started to learn how to open that cabinet without the magnet making that click, click noise. And I thought, this was a gift from Jesus. Obviously, Jesus wants me in here. I've got some skills, right? So I'm reaching, I open that, and I'm looking around for Mary, and I find Mary, and I screw the head off Mary, and I take a swig of that poutine. Now, I don't know about moonshine, but poutine, you actually can't breathe when you drink poutine. You're like, but you know, don't you, that it's going to be absolutely worth it. It's going to be worth it, and you know it is, because you can't breathe. That's a really good sign. And so I'd finally be able to catch my breath, screw Mary's head back on, pop her back in the bar. And I'd be delighted with myself. For about 20 minutes, I'd be smoking cigarette butts, and I'd be dancing around the kitchen. And I'd be saying, oh no, I'm grand now. I don't need any more. 20 minutes later, I'm back over looking for Mary, which actually sums up my whole drinking. My whole drinking. From the age of 10 on, like, no, this will do me. No, I won't need any more after this. Jesus, that went quick, didn't it? So back over I go, right? So, so that sums up my drinking. And I want to share this, and you don't have to identify with this. It just happens to be my story. That so I was 10 and I started to drink. And I had this feeling, you know, that... The trouble was, I was wound really tight as a kid, like really tight. And I was very, very concerned all the time. And I should have been. I lived in a house where you had to duck real quick every time anybody moved by you, you know. So it's like I should have been concerned, but I was super concerned. And when I started drinking, that left me. And I just felt kind of indifferent and arrogant and not interested in your sad little life and not interested in you. I loved that feeling of indifference to you. Like, really, you know, loved it. So I had that feeling and obsession kicked in immediately as soon as I started drinking. Like, wow, this is what it feels like not to be that anxious all the time at the age of 10. Wow. Now, when I got sober, my first 10 years of sobriety, I had 2 ulcers because I got very intense again. It took me a long, long time to slow my roll without booze, you know. But, and also at that time, suddenly a thought came to me. And this is the part you don't have to identify with. But suddenly a thought came to me. Jesus, wouldn't be good to cut yourself right now. Jesus, that's a great idea. Off I'd go upstairs, look for a razor blade, I'd look for something. And I started cutting myself from my first independent drinking like that. I thought was a great idea. Like, where does that come from? Like, where does that come from? But that was how it was for me from the age of 10. And that was always part of my drink. It was a big secret for me. I never told anybody. I tried to hide it the best I could. A couple of times I got into a lot of trouble with that where I couldn't. I was too drunk and did too much damage. And people found out, you know. But it was an idea that I had as soon as I started drinking at 10. And kept me sober, actually, for the new people. Kept me sober for a while because I knew that went along with it. Just terrified me sober. And because I didn't understand it, you know. I still don't really, to be honest with you. So that's how it was for me. My drinking took off and I started drinking at school. I was in Catholic school, Irish Catholic. David, I'm Irish Catholic. I'd run over to the liquor store and I would get 4 cans of wine. Cans of wine. I don't think I'd even ever really seen a grape. And I'd get 4 cans of wine with my lunch money, because who needs food? And I'd go into the toilets alone, because I'm not a sharer. And I'd pound down those 4 cans in the 30 minutes I had left. And I'd go back to class. And of course, I was in remedial for everything. But apart from sports and singing, these are my 2 little things. Yay! I had a hard time with everything else. But so I'd go back to class. Now, I'm cursed being Irish because, really being from Ireland, I'm cursed because when I drink, I go like red, almost purple from the neck up. And my eyes are like piss holes in the snow. And it's like they're like back up, like beep, beep. And I'm crazed, right? I'm like crazy, purpley crazy. That's how I am drinking. And so I go back to class and people go, Jesus, are you all right? You know, and, oh yeah, I'm fine, you know. So I was lit up. And then I found a little job at night collecting glasses in an Irish bar when I was, I don't know, 13, 14, 15. I used to go into this Irish club at night and I collect glasses, but I was able to steal the booze from behind the bar when the shutters went down, hand straight up to the optics, get anything I wanted, get that down me, clean the glasses. And then, of course, there was glass there, so I was able to cut myself. It was a grand old time. I mean, it was like I had arrived and I got paid. So, you know, I found a way. Then I started a prayer group, a prayer group upstairs from the Irish club. There was a little room at the top. and I had this prayer group. And the only reason I had the prayer group up there was because I'd have people in the prayer group. And then I knew there was cheap booze downstairs in the Irish club. I could hardly get the prayer group over in time, you know, to get to go down and start drinking. So here it is for me. You look at my life. It was like obsession. Like, I didn't know that at the time. But like from the age of 10, when I wasn't drinking and thinking about drinking, I was getting over or planning my next drink. That's how it was. Like, I see that now, sober, retrospect. Everything I did had to have booze involved. And my life revolved around it. And I was in obsession right from the gate. I've never really had a social drink in my life. I hear people talking about social drinking. Now, you might have thought I was socially drinking, but I'm not really social. Like, I'm trying to find people to go and drink with, because as a young woman in the East End of London, you know, it's not very, you know. And I'd find somebody and I'd generally be saying, I'd be drinking with them and they'd be talking. I'd be thinking to myself, oh my God, is this guy, this guy's got personality of a pigeon. Jesus Christ. When is he going to get the next round in? Blah, blah, blah. Like, that's how my head was. I wasn't really socializing with them. I just wanted to look like I was socializing with them. Because I'm really getting more and more antisocial. The more I'm drinking, I'm getting more and more antisocial, getting more and more hostile. The more and more indifferent I become to you. And that's just how it was for me. And more feisty. Now, you can't tell because we're on screen. But I'm actually only 4'11". I know I sound tall. However, I'm only 4'11". And I'd be going into places, going up to the biggest guy, going, did you say something to me? Do you want something? They were like, what? Like, so I really had a mouth and a half. I was hostile. I drank in places only generally where men drank. I'd shoot pool with all these guys. And, you know, it was crazy. My whole life was consumed around booze. I left school, had very little education, which was irrelevant. Education did not matter in my house. My father was totally illiterate, couldn't even sign his own name. And my mother was semi-illiterate. She got married at 15. She was married and pregnant at 15 in Ireland. And she was involved in all this criminal activity. So she didn't really need any hassle. Nobody was going to parents evening for me. And so I left school with no education, had a very hard time reading and writing. And frankly, I didn't care. My mother thought, boy, did she get this wrong. She said to me, when are you going to get out of that school uniform and find yourself a man to take care of you? She got that wrong. Oh, boy. So I'm like, and she's dressed me in pink. I have no clue what that's all about. Me in pink. All right. Okay. So, you know, for me, when I think I started working in the East End of London, I got a job as an auxiliary nurse in the East End of London. And because I had no education, and I decided I was going to become a nun. That's right, people. I was going to become a sister. I know. And so I said to them, the Irish is the charity ran that place. And I said to them, oh, I'm thinking of becoming a nun. And I had a big cross on me. It's like, if I wear the cross, that makes me a nun, right? Isn't that how it is? I don't know. So I wore this big cross and I said, you know, I'm becoming a nun. I'm going to enter the Franciscan Missionaries of Mary after I've, you know, got some experience under my belt of nursing. You know, could you put me on the floor in the nurse's home with all the other nuns? That was their first mistake because they believed me. So they put me on the floor. I was two doors down from my unit, which was lethal. Do you know, remember that Dolly Parton song? Two doors down, they're laughing and drinking and having a party. Two doors down, they're not aware that I'm around, right? I thought it was like perfect because my room was two doors down from the ward. I could shoot out in between patients and get a swig of whiskey down me, drop a vodka, whatever I'm doing, and go back to the unit. Nobody knows anything. Perfect. Also, I'm a barfly. I love being, because I like being, I'm a little feisty, if you haven't guessed, and I like a lot of energy and a little aggression going on. And so I'd start drinking at home and I'd make my way over to the bar. You know, when you click your heels, you end up somewhere. Here I am. It's like a magic carpet ride. For the new people, that's a blackout. It's like, where am I? Oh, okay. So I used to start drinking in the little room. And I had this small little room. It was like a 3x6 little room in the nurse's quarters. And it was immaculate. I wouldn't use the bin, nothing. And I'd be singing Guns N' Roses, you know. Turn around, bitch, I got use for you. Besides, you ain't got nothing better to do and I'm bored. And I'm like, yeah, crazed, right, crazed in the room. Party of one. And do you remember that song? White lines going through my mind. Boom, boom. And all the while I think of you. Boom, boom. Oh, my God. A bottle of whiskey and a pack of razor blades, I'm your woman. It's like, woof. So that was what was going on. That was before I go out to the pubs. That's what I was wandering into the bars with. And I'd have Sister Anne knocking on the door saying, Jesus, Julie, are you okay, love? And I'd be in the room crazed, you know, singing crazy. hurting myself, doing all that business, going back out to the bar. And then I used to put all my empties in Sister Anne's bin. She was next door to me at night. And I'd put all my empties in her bin because she'd be in bed about 8 o'clock. And I'd be out all night and I'd put all the empties in her bin. And I'd hear the Irish staff next morning. It was these girls from, my accent's from the Midlands, and these girls were from Cork. And so they had a, they'd, like, it was like the south of Ireland. And they were all the domestic staff, and they'd be going, I'd hear them, Jesus, girl, did you see Sister Anne's bin? I think she's a bit of an alky. And I thought it was hilarious, hilarious. Like, I was getting away with something. But it was such a disaster, I was getting away with nothing. You think you are at the time, right? So, you know, I was getting into a lot of trouble. I tried to control and enjoy my drinking. What a disaster. Like, I really don't want to control and enjoy my drinking, but I'm starting to get some social pressure. People don't like it when I'm drunk on the unit. People don't like it when I'm up at 3 o'clock in the morning, crazed. People are thinking less of me. And I don't like that, frankly, because, you know, I'm sensitive. And I'm getting this pressure. I really don't see the point in controlling and enjoying your drinking. I really don't. Like, I like what the big book says about being more or less insanely drunk. That's how I like to roll. I don't understand any other way. It would be such a waste to have 3 drinks, wouldn't it? Well, only when you're starting to feel it, you're going to stop. What? I don't understand that concept, which is, I guess, why I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I have sisters who understand that concept. They're feeling it and they're stuck. I'm like, what? You're putting the cork in the bottle of wine. There's only 5 glasses you can get out of that. Why would you? What? I don't understand that. It's like 5 glasses before you go out for a drink. Why are you putting the cork back in it, for Christ's sake? So that is how I think about booze, my relationship with alcohol. I just don't grasp that concept. You know, so I started to get into a lot of trouble. Now I'm starting to swim. I swim. I'm a huge swimmer. I always have been. And I can swim for a long time and still swim all the way through my sobriety. I've been able to swim on and off through COVID, but I've really missed it. I had to get myself a rowing machine to take the edge off because I can't swim. But, you know, I started to swim and I'd do like a split shift at work and I'd go over to the pool at 1 o'clock. And I'd swim 100 laps in 80 minutes, right? And then I'd get changed and I'd go double whiskey, double whiskey, double whiskey back to work. And people would say to me, because I'm lit up, they'd be like, have you been drinking? And I'd go, can you swim 100 laps in 80 minutes? And they'd be like, what? And I go, no, when you can, get back to me. I'm like, what? Like, yeah, that's right. That's how I think about things. And so I started to get into trouble. I got into a fight on the unit. And here's something. If you be alcoholic, you'll understand this concept. There was a big Fijian girl at work. She was sitting down one day. And I thought, well, she'd have to be sitting down because I told you I'm 4'11". And she was sitting down. And I thought it'd be hilarious to cut a big chunk out of her hair. Isn't that hilarious, right? Because we carry scissors with us. So I did. She didn't find it funny. There was like hair flying between the two of us. She picked up a chair. She threw it at me. I mean, I was like, Jesus, you need to get a sense of humor. I mean, that's how I was. I was just so unlikable. Anyway, I got demoted. Like, I could go any lower than what I was doing. And I ended up in the day center and I was drinking in the ambulance before I picked patients up. And the guy thought it was funny because I was a big joke. And I started to, you know, I woke up one morning, had this glow in the dark cherry tracksuit. I mean, really, it was glow in the dark, mate. You could turn off them lights and find me. It was glow. I was like, who's is this? I obviously bought it in blackout. I figured it was mine. So I used to wear that because it was easy, you know. And I'd have a few drinks and I'd go over to evening prayer because I'm still becoming a nun. And I'd go over to evening vespers and I'd be like, they'd be in the front singing. All the real nuns would be in the front. And I had my hair shaved. This is relatively long. I just got my hair cut yesterday here in Vegas. Yay. But my hair was like on a wand. Shaved all the way on a one. I used to have like this blue tack to keep my hat, my nurse's hat on. So I'd have my hair shaved and I'd have this cherry glow in the dark tracksuit. And I'd be singing in the back and I'd be all lit up and I'd be thinking, God, these girls can't hold a tune. I'm going to help them. And I'd be drunk in the back and I'm like, Salve Regina. You know, I'm like, Mate misericordia, vita dulcedo, espes nostra salve, right? Because I've got it going on. And I, these women are looking at, going, looking back at me and I'm lit up, my hair shaved, my tracksuit. And I know they're going, oh, thanks, girl. Thanks, Julie, for helping the sisters out, right? No. I now know they were going, what the hell is that in the back of the room? So I thought, no, I was a bit delusional, if you get me point. So I let, you know, so this is what I want to say. I had a moment of clarity. I went to the, I saw an advert for Castlemaine Forex and I was just turning 21. And I went to Australia and I was on a glass bottom boat in the Great Barrier Reef, one of the seven wonders of the world. And I'm on this glass bottom boat and there's girls my age, right? 20, 21. I was turning 21 in September. Yes, I'm a Virgo. And August, I was in the Great Barrier Reef. I'm on my own because, you know, I haven't got any friends because I'm totally unlikable. And I'm drinking a can of Foster's, which is a beautiful thing. And I pay extra for this glass bottom boat, you know, because I don't want anyone to think I can't afford it. And my working class roots. I'm like, no, I'm going to pay the most expensive thing. So there's girls my age and they're all in bikinis, you know, and they're like, let's go snorkeling. And I'm like, look at those silly bitches. Look at them. They're pathetic, right? Now, I was doing that because I'm sitting there with kind of Foster's in my hand. I've cut my arm so badly that I've got long sleeves on me. And I'm so ashamed of my body at that time that, you know, I wouldn't put a bikini on or a swimsuit on. Now, I look back at those pictures when I was that young and I was banging, you know what I'm saying? But at 20, you don't think you're banging. You're like, oh, no. So anyway, I started taking pictures of the can of Foster's and I'm like, oh, this is beautiful. Look at the way the sun is hitting that kangaroo on the can. And the blue is really lovely, frankly. And I found, I have lots of pictures of that can of Foster's and I have not got one picture of the Great Barrier Reef. And I was on a glass bottom boat. All I had to do was say, excuse me a minute. Click, never ever happened, never even came into my consciousness. Obsession. So I say that I come home, I realize like there's something off with me, and it's not a newsflash. I go back to work, and somebody pissed me off. And frankly, it's not difficult right now. I've got a very, very short, I've always had a very short fuse, it's got longer the longer sober I am, but then I had a very short fuse, like I was like a Rottweiler with lipstick. Oh my god. Whew. Somebody pissed me off and I told you it's not difficult, and I ended up going into my room, cracking open a bottle of whiskey, and I'm looking out the window and I'm singing with Patsy Cline, you know, me and Patsy have got going on. And so I'm looking out the window and I'm like, today I sail on at a window, because I was at a window, you know, I was looking out the window. I don't want to play house. No, I don't want to play house. Crazy. Go back over to the sink and I cut myself really badly. And the big book talks about being at a jumping off place. And in that moment at 21 years of age, I was at a jumping off place with booze. And I caught sight of myself I was kind of struck sober. And I would cut eyes with myself in the mirror and I just thought, what are you going to do? You can't live with booze and you can't live without it. And I picked up the bottle of whiskey and I drank for another 3.5 years. And, you know, my last drink, so when I get sober, my last drink, I went to live at a convent in the Ursuline Convent in London. And I was going to get sober and I really meant it. I wasn't going to hurt myself anymore. I was going to get sober and I was going to get spiritually fit. And then I was going to join the convent as a novice or a postulant. And I really meant it. Wasn't going to do any of this anymore. And they did a lovely room for me. It was the nicest thing I'd ever had in my life. I was always raised with secondhand stuff because we never had any money. I was like welfare, basically. And so it was really lovely, this room. And they did it all nice to me. 2 days later, I'm so drunk that I smash up that room, put my fist through the wardrobe, because, you know, it's my favorite, and smash up the lamp and anything nice I ever had. I was getting more and more violent. I was breaking, just really violent. Not to anybody else, just to inanimate objects and myself. And I drank for another 9 months like that. I was there 2 days, and these nuns were carrying me up and down outside the front waiting for the ambulance to come. I was so sick from booze. And it was all going to be different. I lasted 2 days. It's all going to be different. And, you know, the book talks about this, right, doesn't it? The book says, you know, like, if you ask the alcoholic why they started drinking or why they're drinking, knowing what it does to them, they'd make up all these excuses. Well, this happened to me when I was a kid, and this happened. And I thought that was what it was. But the truth is, I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows. I didn't know that before I entered Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought it was my life. I mean, I was really had a very rough upbringing, and a lot happened. And I thought that's why I lived how I lived and how I drank how I drank. And I didn't know. And my sponsor says, that won't make you alcoholic. That just gives you an inventory. I was like, oh, because I've met people in the fellowship who've had like charmed lives and are still alcoholic. So I had to grasp that concept about being bodily and mentally different. My last drink, I ended up apparently in front of 60 young people. I was in total blackout. I told Sister Anne where to go in the chapel in front of 60 young people, and I'd cut myself and bled all over the carpet. It's never good. And I wake up the next morning, my room's all smashed up, nobody's speaking to me. I'm sick as a dog, because now I'm getting really sick. I'm crawling to the bathroom at 24, crawling to the bathroom, and I'm on my hands and knees and I'm bringing up blood. And I make a decision in that moment to kill myself, because, and I don't say this lightly, I really mean this, I was such a loser. Like, I'd never worked anywhere, that I never paid a bill, because anywhere I worked, they paid the bills and then handed me my spending money, my sweet money. I'd never driven a car. I had no education. I had never been in a relationship. Like, I had some stalking experiences, some obsessions, because, you know, why not? They're very safe and they're mine. And so we're all having a good time in that. But I've never really lived a life. Like, when I drink, that's what I do. I can't achieve anything when I'm drinking. I don't know how people are able to achieve stuff. They do. I mean, you know, I know lots of people who do. I was never able to. And I was too sick right from the gate. And, you know, I make a decision that morning to kill myself. And I go upstairs and I talk to this guy. He's an Irish guy, and he'd seen me perform the night before. And the thing is, I was living in a house with all these British people. And if you're British, or if you know any British, you know that the British are a little bit anal. And, you know, not like the Irish, we let our hair down, we have a good time. And so he basically 12-stepped me. And I listened to him because he was Irish, and he was only 9 months sober, 9 months sober. And I'm like, I got sober in 1993. So I'm like 27 years and 10 months sober based on this guy's 9 months, 12 step. He was on fire with the fellowship. And he brought me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was going to kill myself. So what do I care? And he brought me to my first meeting. It was a real small, smoky meeting on a Wednesday night. And it was April 1993, and everyone was smoking, drinking coffee, swearing and carrying on. Somebody was selling some swag out the back of the truck of the car. It was all great. And I go to this meeting, and I don't necessarily identify too much with the speaker. They'd gone to mental institutions, prison, and I hadn't done any of that. I'd been very good at surrounding myself with caretakers, maybe Al-Anon, who looked after me. And I didn't get into too much trouble and in that way. And I should have, but anyway, it's a whole different story. But anyway, you know, but I ended up, the first meeting, the woman gave me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was suspicious immediately. I'm like, well, what's this now? And who are you? And what do you want from me? She's like, call me. And I'm like, that's not going to be happening. So, you know, I was suspicious. Because, you know, at that time, I was used to hanging around with men, not women. Women weren't as malleable, shall we say, as the men were. And I'd, you know, I took the book and went home. And I woke up the next morning. This is how crazy I am. I'm like, oh, my God, this AA really works. Because I'm crazy. I hadn't had a drink for 5 days. And that was the longest I'd gone I could remember from, you know, whatever. And I have to say, and I'm really sorry if you're new, that intensity that I had when I was a kid before I started drinking, when I got sober, that came back like, oh my God, like I felt like I was being punched in the back of the head. Like I was either super, super angry or super, super depressed my first year or so of the fellowship. I couldn't think straight. People annoyed me. Oh my God, they annoyed me. And I was intense. Like somebody'd meet me on the stairs, and this wasn't a recovery home or anything. It was like normal people taking a year out before college. What would I know about? And they'd come down the stairs and they'd go, "Morning, Julie, how are you?" And I'd go, "Oh my God, did you know I was abused when I was 5? And people are like, "Jesus Christ." You know, I was like full on, and I had no boundaries. And I was intense. And the first piece of discipline I learned. I was about 3 months sober and I walk everywhere. They used to call me the walker in London because I'd walk everywhere. I had absolutely no money. They let me stay in the convent. I did some work there and that was my board. I had no money at all. And I used to walk to these meetings, and this meeting on a Wednesday night was a 2.5 hour walk there. I have sponsees right now who won't walk around the corner. I'm like, what? In California? I'm like, why were you at the meeting? Oh, my ride didn't come. What? I walk. You're not doing anything. Why can't you walk? I'll give you a lift home. Oh, I'm so tired. You don't work. What do you mean you're tired? I really don't care. So, you know, whatever. Or, you know, what about if somebody sees me on the bus? Well, you were probably pissing in the bushes last week. You didn't really mind about that, but you're concerned now about them being on the, oh, okay, seeing you on the, oh, okay, thanks. So, you know, I walked everywhere, 2.5 hours to this meeting on a Wednesday night. In London, where it's cold, people. And I'd be walking, right? And people would be tooting their horns. And I automatically would give them the bird because I'm thinking they want a piece of this, right? Because I'm crazy and hostile. Now, I know that nobody wanted a piece of this, all right? I was too crazy. And, but I'm like, oh, you know, I was doing this the whole time. And I'd get to the meeting of these old Irish guys that go, "Jesus, Julie, I saw you walking. And I toot the horn to pull over. You gave me the bird." And I thought, oh, feck her, let her walk. And I was like, oh, my God. I started to get so embarrassed. I'm like, oh, my God, you can see me. Because, you know, in my drinking, I would abuse you. And then you'd go to speak. And I'd go, shh, don't speak. You'll spoil it. And I'd walk off. People are like, what? That's how it was. I never waited for a comeback. And so now I'm sober, I'm showing up to these meetings. So I ended up practicing not automatically giving people the bird. First piece of discipline in Alcoholics Anonymous. Be walking to this meeting on Wednesday night, someone would toot the horn, I wouldn't automatically do what I felt like. And they'd pull over and I'd get lifts to meetings that way. It was a 2.5 hour walk, people. So that was my first piece of discipline. Then, you know, people say things like, "Oh, Julie, will you help put away the chairs?" And I'm like, well, I'll put my chair away. Why would I put yours away? Like, I don't know. Or, you know, "Could you help put away the ashtrays?" And I'm like, well, no, because I don't smoke. So no, I'm not doing that. Or they'd be like, you know, "Could you help make the tea and coffee?" And I'm like, I don't drink hot beverages, which was such a lie. I did. But I just felt like you were trying to take advantage of me. And I don't appreciate. And this is a little bit raw, but I remember, this will give you an example. I remember clearly about being about 2 or 3 years sober, mind you. And I went into a meeting at lunchtime in the East End of London. And it was all guys sitting there, you know. And one of the old guys goes, "Oh, it's all right. Julie's here now. She can make the tea." And I went, "What? Because I've got a pair of knockers. I'm making the tea." I mean, these guys, it was like blowback. Like, I'm mortified now. And I think that's how I was 2 or 3 years ago. I was so hostile. And, you know, I'm like, oh, God, you know, it's good for me to remember that stuff because, you know, I work with newcomers. It's like, yeah. So I started to learn how to be a little bit more disciplined, to help put away the chairs, to help put, because that gets really lonely. And I also had a hard time reading and writing. You know, I had a hard time reading and writing. A friend of mine taught me how to do my ABCs and read a newspaper and all that business and the dictionary, so I could have, you know, read a little bit in AA. Now, I didn't crack open the big book until I was about, it's not recommended newcomers, it is my story, however. I didn't crack open the big book until I was about 3 years sober. And you know where they said, because I had such a hard time reading, and you know where it said in the, people, I used to hear people saying, you know, half measures availed us nothing, right? I thought, because I'd never read the big book for 3 years, that people were reading half measures of ale did nothing. And I'd be like, oh, Julie, alcoholic. Oh, no, half a measure of ale never did me any good. And people are like, what the? I remember reading that for the very first time. I remember exactly where I was. I cracked open that and I was like, oh, my God, you moron. Like, I was mortified. And, you know, mortified. So I started to read the big book and I started to, you know, got involved. I was about 20 months sober and I met my wife. Didn't even know I was lesbian. Had no clue. And I was at an AA convention and I was like, oh my God, I was just horrified. Like trying to stay sober isn't enough. Now I've got, like, what? So I ended up, you know, dating my wife. My wife is the same length sober as I am, although I'm three months longer sober. It's important. And she, very kind woman. We've actually been together over 26 years and have a lovely little relationship. In fact, she's in Georgia. She lost her job in COVID. So she's in Georgia working. She's got a fantastic position. And I'm in Los Angeles. And we decided, she really wanted, it was a job that she really wanted. And I was like, look, babe, let's just try it for a year and see what happens. And it's been kind of cool because we get to see each other on Zoom. She speaks a lot. She speaks a lot more than me. And so I get to see her speaking a lot on Zoom. She'll get to tune in when I'm speaking. And then we get to make it fun. Like, we met each other here in Vegas on Saturday morning. I'm like, why don't we meet in Vegas and have a little bit of a blowout? Go out for dinner somewhere, do something like that. Because you can't do that in California. So we're here in Vegas enjoying each other. We've made little trips out of it. And I said, you know, I have an AA commitment. She's like, all right, baby. She did that on our honeymoon. So we went back arse of nowhere for our honeymoon. So she could speak at this AA. I was like, you owe me really big time. So AA has always been in the center. But so anyway, I say that to say this, that I started to get involved in a relationship, started to kind of have to manage all that business that went with that. As an Irish Catholic, that was very painful for me. And, you know, one day I hadn't done any step work. And one day she said something to me that I didn't like. And I kicked the door in her face and she shot back. The door missed her, right? And she started crying and I started crying. I was so ashamed because you can drop me. I'm a survivor. You can drop me in wherever you want. I'll spin out what I think you want from me and then you can wander off, mind your own business. How about that? So I'm really good at that, you know. But step 6 and 7 talks about, in the 12 and 12, about what am I doing in the dark? What am I doing in the dark? And what am I doing at home? What about the people I live with? How sober would they say I was, right? So she looked at me, she started crying and I was so ashamed of myself. And I got a sponsor, 3 years sober. And I started to go through the steps and I really struggled because, you know, step 4 is really hard when you think that you're the victim. I mean, it was a project because I was dragged up. I was like, well, I was just defending myself. Well, if you had my life, you don't get it. If you had my life, you would be like me too. And the fourth column in the fourth step, you know, where am I to blame? What now? What? No, you got that twisted. I was never their pursuer. I was the pursued. I was the one who people were taking advantage of. Oh, really? So I started to look at those, and I started to look at what kind of, so painful, started to look at what kind of person I really was. And to be truthful, I was very indifferent. I was indifferent to family. I was indifferent to everybody. You'd give me your number and you think we were best friends, and as soon as you're gone out of sight, I'm just going to get rid of that number. It's indifferent to people. And that was painful. And then I thought what kind of sister I was. And I have a lot of siblings, and it's funny, there's six of us, six kids. And my first fourth step only had 10 people on it. Because I was that indifferent. And my sponsor at the time goes, don't you have a lot of siblings? And I go, yeah. I was so indifferent. And I realized that I was a kind of person who would never let people close to me. Now, I've always struggled with depression, always. And it really pisses me off when people say it's like, your spiritual condition. Like, educate yourself, will you? Read a book or something about it. Don't be spouting off something you don't know about. So it's like, yeah, I've always struggled with that. And thank God for Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson really struggles. And he wrote his book, Letters to Father Dowling. He talks about his own struggle with depression, which has been a lifesaver for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've learned how to manage that sober, and it doesn't interfere with my functioning. And my function's pretty high. I'm pretty busy a lot of the time. But I manage it. And, you know, I would never let my sisters know that. You know, they'd call and, how are you? Oh, yeah, I'm grand. What about you? Now, I could have been in the depths of depression. I could have been whatever. Oh, yeah, I'm grand. What about you? Like, just thank you. Just stay there, why don't you? And I started to have to get a little bit more vulnerable and just say to them, you know, I'm struggling a little bit today. So hard for me, because I felt like I was going to be judged and criticized. And it was so painful for me. But I started to do that piece by piece. And, you know, my parents were really hard to make amends to. My mother always kills me talking about my mom. My mom passed away 2.5 years ago, and I've never quite been the same since my mom passed away. It's really left a mark on me, because, you know, I had a very volatile relationship with my mom. I was never volatile to her. She was a very violent woman, and alcoholic violent woman. And she knocked my eardrum out one time, you know, and I got to the doctor. The doctor says, have you just been punched in the ear recently? And I said, actually, yes. So I get in the car, my mother goes, well, I said, oh, he asked me if I'd been punched. Don't talk. she says, you must have been combing your hair and pulled it to her. Oh, okay. All right then. So, you know, that's how it was. But I've had a lot of damage in this side of my head. And my mother was right-handed. And so, you know, I had this tumultuous relationship. I loved my mother, and I've always loved my mother. And I started to build a relationship with her sober. I started to say, now in our house, we're not physical or demonstrative at all. And I try and say on the phone, oh, love you. Like, oh, God. And she was never able to say it to me. She'd just say, oh yeah, thanks, love. Bye now. I could never. But I tried to, because I wanted to try and create a relationship with my mom. When I turned 5 years sober, I actually went back to school and I learned how to read and write, and I got a bachelor's degree. Since then, I've got a bachelor's degree. I got two masters and a doctorate. But I heard a speaker recently. It's like, everybody, nobody has to go back to school. They want to. Okay. It's like, I'm not saying you have to. That was just my path. So do some work on that. You'll be all, I'm so angry about it. But that was just my path. I've done a lot of education. But nobody in my family had any education at all. I told you, both my parents were pretty illiterate. And 5 years sober, I just finished all my step work. And I was getting the first degree in my family ever. It was a bachelor's degree in education and youth work. You know, I suppose I want to say this. When I started this, it was like at the YMCA, and I got into that course because of the work I'd been doing. We're in the youth service, and they let me in, and we got first paper, right? And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to college. Go to college, first person in my family ever to go to college. Oh my God, I'm going to college, right? So I we got our first paper, and the Pasum result was 37. And I thought, oh, okay, so we get our papers back this day. And I'm so frightened to look at mine because I know that I'm not going to pass because I've got no formal education. I know I'm not going to pass. And I really liked the idea of going to college. I liked that. I was like 2 years sober and I liked the idea of doing something like that. And so I was really frightened. So everybody in my class were getting, oh my God, I got 98. Oh my God, I got 97. Oh my God, I got, and they're like, what did you get? And I go, I don't know, I haven't looked. And I couldn't look for 3 days. I just sat in that room with that bloody paper in the drawer because I knew the jig was up. I knew that people like me, and it really kills me to think of it now. Like, I knew people like me don't do this kind of thing. I don't do this kind of thing. And I waited 3 days to look at that paper because I knew that I was going to have to leave school, that I'd failed that paper. It was my very first paper. And I opened it and I got 37, the pass mark, right? And so I didn't get your 97s or your 98s. I didn't get any of that. I got 37. And because I got 37, I was able to build on that. And I got better and better. And like I said, I have a doctorate now. And but it was that first one that was so hard, you know. And these are important things to me. And the disciplines I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous has given me an opportunity to build a life for myself, to build a career for myself. Like, I have surrounded my life. I've been in the middle of the bed in Alcoholics Anonymous for over 27 years. And I was 24 and a half when I got sober, and I'm 53 this year. I know, shock, I don't look it, but I am. But because of that, I've built a life for myself, and I've built some integrity, and I, my mom came to that. I graduated 5 years sober, and it was in Canterbury Cathedral. And my mother had to get on a plane from Ireland to London and then a train from London to Canterbury and then find the cathedral. And I couldn't see her. I didn't know she'd arrived. And I'd done all this step work. And it was the first time I was going to see my mom after doing all the step work. And I was always so resentful at my mother. I just thought I was better than her because I never had children. I'm like, at least I didn't bring children into this world. So I always thought it was superior to her. And all that left me when I started to look at where was I to blame, you know? And I wander into the cathedral and the trumpets are blowing and I catch eyes with my mom and she's really tore back. She's hung over. My mother threw up every morning of my life. That's how I woke up every morning as a kid. She was hung over. And I knew the steps were working because I was delighted she made it. I was delighted she made it. And I knew that she had to get on a train. And I knew she was hungover because she was celebrating me the night before. And I brought my mom to the airport. It was the first time I'd felt softness towards my mother, you know, tenderness. And I brought my mom to the airport. And I give her a hug. And we don't touch in my house. Like I said, we duck real quick if somebody's going to reach out. And I hug my mother. And she whispers, I'm really proud of you. And she left. It was a beautiful turnaround in our relationship. And, you know, I started to really, I'm just looking for the time on my clock. I'll have it. Build a relationship for my mom. And I learned a lot of things from my mom. Like my mom at times didn't have any money and I'd give her money and then I'd expect her to spend it on what she told me she was going to, like the phone bill. And I had to learn that, I don't get to do that. And she started to get, I give her the money, she has to decide what she's going to do with. And she started to get Alzheimer's, dementia actually, alcohol induced dementia, and then into Alzheimer's. And I remember this day I bought her briquettes, you know, firing for the fireplace. I used to buy her briquettes every week for a couple of years because she couldn't grasp it. And I pull up one day and her sister takes the briquettes into her own house. My mother's sitting there, you need briquettes in Ireland for the water and the heating. And I get out of the car all large and in charge. And I go, what's going on here, right? And I'm just giving these to her. Blah, blah, blah. So I went to the house and I go to my mother, what the, blah, blah, blah. And she goes to me, come here a minute. And this is her with even Alzheimer's. Come here a minute. She says, did you not give me them briquettes? Did you not buy them briquettes for me? And I said, well, yeah, I did. Yeah. And I'm all like all puffed up. And she goes, well, then if they're mine, can't I do what I want with them, or are they not mine? I was like, oh, when you put it like that, sure. So, you know, to learn those things about myself and about what drives me and ego and all that business. And I built a beautiful relationship with my mom, you know, and, you know, my mother, I brought her to a nursing home. We got her settled in a nursing home and got her set up there. And one day I was sitting on the bed and I made a little joke and she reached for my face and I didn't flinch. And it was the first time. And she goes to me, she grabs my cheeks and she goes, look at them fat little cheeks. And it was a lovely little moment, you know. And then another time I was putting the seatbelt on her and she thought I was cuddling her. She gave me a biggest hug. And my mum used to say things like, Julie, do you want a cuddle? Julie, everything in me, if I hadn't done any work enough, I'd be like, no, thanks. And because of the work I did in AA, I was able to love on her. And I've really struggled when she left because we had such a beautiful relationship. You know, I was able to, as we'd say in Ireland, I was able to mind her. And she died of a massive heart attack. I went home for the funeral. And my siblings asked me if I would do the talk at the funeral. And I'm the second youngest. So I'm like, well, why would I be doing it? I'm the second youngest. And they're like, you know, Mammy knew you were sober. I just turned 25 years sober at the time. And I put my chip in my mom's hands. My mom got buried with it. And they said, you know, Mammy knows that you speak in AA and she knows that you're sober. And I think she'd really love you to speak. Now, my sisters don't, or my family are not involved in AA. They've never heard me speak. They're not interested, whatever. But they knew that. And because of that, I got to do the eulogy at my mom's funeral. And that was a beautiful gift of AA. You know, I think my time is on up. I want to say this, that I made a decision not to have a relationship with my father. I had to realize about 9 years sober that my father was too unwell to have a relationship with. I kept going in there because you hear people in AA, right, going, oh, you've only got one mother and one father. Oh, okay. Oh, all right then. All right then. 9 years sober, I realized he was just too unwell to have a relationship with. And that was a mature, grown-up decision that I made through therapy and through my sponsor and through a lot of step work. But it took me 9 years. I kept going in there and going in there and realized. And when my dad passed away, I went home to his funeral and I held my own and I was respectful. And I've never regretted that decision. And thank God I've had sponsors who understood that, who didn't just give me this, oh, you've only got one. It's like, you know, there's room for all of us here. And that's not a popular thing for me to say, but it happens to be my experience. I'm going to finish this last thing. In the morning, I wake up anxious. So I always do. Now, my wife wakes up singing and she's alcoholic. So I don't know what that's all about. I think it's kind of creepy. I wake up going, oh, my God, what day is it? And who wants something from me? Because you know someone does. I get a cup of tea and I do a prayer meditation. That's not fancy. Page 86, 88, and then page 130, the big book where it says, we've come to believe in a power greater than ourselves. We'd like to keep our head in the clouds with him, but our feet ought to be firmly planted on earth. Why? Because that's where our fellow travelers are. And that is where our work must be done. Oh, okay. How can I lighten up my little corner of the world today and not be large and in charge? And that has really helped me a lot. And with that, I'm going to be quiet. And thanks for letting me share.
Oh, thank you so much. That was amazing. Thank you. I'm going to unmute everybody or allow you to unmute and thank Julie.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Awesome, Julie.
That was amazing.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you, Julie. That was awesome.
Thank you so much. Beautiful. Thank you so much.
All right. I'm going to take the meeting back one more time. We'll give Julie a little bit of a break. We'll do a little business. Remember the questions that we're going to hang out for another 25 minutes or so. And the questions that we're going to ask Julie are the questions that you send in to the user questions. So please do that. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I will take a couple of announcements. Ebony, oh, let me allow you. There you go.
Hey, all, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ebony. This Wednesday, January the 27th at 7 p.m., Norfolk District 14 will be hosting a 12 Concepts workshop. We're going to be doing this the fourth Wednesday of every month for the rest of 2021. This month, we will have Christy E., the chairwoman of the VAC. I like it because it's cute, because it rhymes. She's going to be speaking on Concept 1. We have the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, the 12 concepts. Don't know what the concepts are? Great way to come and find out. She'll be speaking for about 30 to 40 minutes. We'll take a quick break and then open it up for Q&A, much like this meeting. Hope to see you all there, and I'll put the info in the chat. Thanks.
Thank you, Ebony. Larry.
Hey, I am question. No, I'm Larry, alcoholic. My home group, Candlelight, Friday at 8 p.m. This Friday, we will have a speaker. Our very own Foy B will be speaking. So please come join us Friday at 8 o'clock. Those of you that know Foy, or anyone for that matter, please join us Friday, 8 o'clock. The link is on the intergroup website. That's Candlelight. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Larry. All right. Is that it? All right. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available right here in this meeting. After we close the meeting, please feel free to stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. If you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. So once again, we're looking for your questions. Let's see what we've got. Julie, thank you again. That was wonderful. The Irish guy who 12-stepped you, did he tell you his story? Did he give an AA pitch? Can we go back to that moment?
He basically, I was kind of a little foggy because I was really hungover, but he basically said, oh, I saw you perform the night previously. And I was like, what? And he says, oh, did you ever try Alcoholics Anonymous? I'm like, why would I be trying Alcoholics Anonymous? And he's like, oh, you know, I've been sober 9 months and I really had a hard time. And he kind of told me a little bit about himself. And then he said, do you want me to pick you up on Wednesday and we'll go to a meeting together? And I was like, sure. And he's still sober too. So I think that was, you know, it was just nice to have an Irish guy talking to me. It's really interesting because, yeah, at that time I was so crazy. I'm like, somebody British would have never worked. Somebody Irish would. So it was perfect.
Awesome. We have a question from the group. How do you avoid drifting into worry, remorse, and morbid reflection?
Oh, what a great question. You know, because I've told you I had two ulcers my first 10 years. And so I'm prone to a little bit of anxiety. I wake up anxious. I told you already, I start first of all with prayer meditation. And I don't know about this COVID-15. I've been exercising my ass off. I've been working out about an hour and a half every morning after prayer meditation. Every morning. Especially because my wife has gone to him on my own, you know. So I've tried to exercise. I have to because I get really anxious and tight. I have to work out. I've always had to work out throughout my sobriety. And then I've had to turn my attention to somebody else. I sponsor people. And so I generally turn myself, my attention to what's next. And I distract myself. And because of that, I haven't had an ulcer for 17 years. But it's the discipline and the desire to want something different for yourself means that I have, when I start to get really anxious, wait, God's in charge. I'll give you an example. I'm a frontline worker, and so I got COVID injection vaccine on Thursday. And Monday I was starting to get really anxious about it. Oh God, like I really don't want to volunteer to go somewhere that they're going to hurt me. And then I've heard people have, I just don't want to do it. And I was getting anxious. And then I realized Thursday morning, Julie, you know, God is everything or he is nothing. Is that not right? Yeah, that's right. All right. Well, you got an appointment. Maybe that's where you should be. Oh, okay. So that really helps me when I think God is everything or he is nothing. It's all right. Everything's all right. I'm able to do that and settle myself down. I think that really keeps my anxiety and worry and remorse. Like, well, I can't do anything about it right now, can I? It's done. If I feel like I owe somebody an amends, I do try and do a step 10 and amend, try to make an amend as quick as possible, because I don't like thinking about it anymore. I don't like going, was I a bit off? Day after day. I haven't heard from them, so maybe I did piss them off. Like, Julie, just call and go, look, I think I was probably a little bit off with you and I want to apologize. Oh, okay. Those things help me not to drag things out for days and days and days. Okay.
You said that you didn't open the big book or start doing step work until years into sobriety. And the question that is written is, why do you think it took so long?
Oof. I do know psychologically why. I think for me, I felt like I was really frightened of people and I didn't trust people. And I didn't really have very many. I told you I was very antisocial when I got sober. People frightened me, and I didn't want to put myself in a position where I was going to be vulnerable or taken advantage of. In my mind, that's how I always lived my life. And so I was, first of all, I had a hard time reading and writing, and I wanted to learn how to read and write first. And then I felt like I felt better when I went to meetings. Like, just sitting in meetings made me feel better for the longest time. And I took a lot from that and from the fellowship. So I got sober on meetings and fellowship for a long time. And then about 3 years sober, that grace period left. I started to feel angry and pissed off again and irritable. And then I knew it was time to do something else. But I think I was just afraid. I was, because I'm afraid of commitment, you know? I don't want to, like you'd say to me, do you want to do the chairs? I don't mind doing the chairs tonight, but what now? In Britain, it was a year commitment. I'm like, you are crazy. I'm not, what? You want me here next week? And then like, what, a week after, for a year? No. Like, I was terrified to commit because I had such lack of discipline. I didn't want to be committed to anybody, frankly, or anything. I just want to be left alone and I want to just go where I feel like. So apparently all those things, I think, combined in me, not wanting to get a sponsor or go through the steps.
There's a question here. Do you find there are any differences between AA in the States versus back home?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, you guys are not going to like this, but when I came here, I was like 7 years sober, right? And like, I was well known in the East End of London. 7 years sobriety in London was big. And I was a woman and it was big. And so, oh, Jesus, how are you, Julie? I'd go to my regular meetings. How are you, Julie? How are you, Julie? How are you? Because it's small AA, right? And I come here to California and I'm like, oh my God, those people are such God squad. Oh my God. Like, and oh my God, oh my God, drove me crazy. And this woman who's a long time sober, and I shared it at a meeting because, you know, I'm like that. And I shared it at a meeting because I'm like large and in charge in Britain. And you're all about sponsorship. They're not necessarily about sponsorship. We don't go, he's my sponsor and she's my, we don't do any of that. It's like somebody, I'll say to somebody, can you take me through the steps? And they'll do that. But it's not, it's very different structurally. And so, you know, this woman said to me one day, she was a long time sober, you know, 30 odd years sober. I'd never even met somebody that long sober. And I was complaining. And she goes to me, honey, she goes, this is a save your ass club. Nobody asked you to come here, blah, blah, blah. And this is where you are. You might think it's different than London, but this is where you are. You best adjust or get drunk. And I remember thinking, because I'm trying to work on my anger. So I'm thinking, this bitch, fuck is it? I'm going on. I go into the bathroom and I'm complaining to myself. And I suddenly hear myself and I go, Julie, you know, you're right. This is where you are. You're in California. You best adapt very quickly or you're going to be in trouble. And so I did that. And then actually I was like 10, 11 years sober and I went back to Ireland for a year. Mother of God. They'd be gone in Ireland. They'd be gone. Oh, don't be talking about that big book right now. It's not just from America. Them Americans. And I'm like, what? Like, oh my God. So that was another discipline for me, just to know why I'm sharing at times and not trying, you know, beat people into submission. I don't have to, because alcoholism will. It's like, all right, I don't have to. So very different. I've been in three different countries sober, living in three different countries sober, and very, very different experiences. But I adapt very quickly. And it was really funny because when I was at home in Ireland, my wife really hated and she left. She came back to the United States and I was a foreign national. So I couldn't, she's an American and I couldn't get back. And I remember I was in so much pain and I really missed her. I was worried about her. She was really depressed. And I was in this huge house, 5-bedroom house surrounded by fields, all on my own. And I remember praying in the morning, God, help me create the kind of fellowship that I'm craving. And in the space of a month, I had 9 women sponsees. Now they didn't, you know, like, this is going to sound very controversial. It's just my experience. As a lesbian in Ireland, in small town, I had the fellas be like, ah, Jesus, you just want to get with them yourself. I'm like, what? What are you talking? What? So it was crazy. But in the space of a month, I had 9 women that I was sponsoring in the space of a month. And so that kept me really busy until I got to come back into the United States again. So that was a very long-winded answer.
No, no. And of course, the question focuses on the difference, but it is interesting. And of the three countries, what's the same? What are the similarities in AA? What do you find everywhere in AA?
You know what? You find pockets of enthusiasm everywhere. You just have to be open to them. And it might not look like your pocket of enthusiasm, but it's going to be another pocket of enthusiasm in a different way. And for me to keep myself open in that way, to look for the pockets of enthusiasm where people are kind when you walk into the room, when people greet you, when people are, hello, love, are you new here? Like, these are the people I want to gravitate to. Not how people sound in AA, but how people greet me and how people are to me. And I try to hold that in mind when I'm in a new meet and I try and go up and say hello to people. I think it's about people's actions. What is it Dr. Bob used to say? Carry the message and when necessary, speak. So, yeah.
Yeah, wonderful. Let's see. What is the biggest difference you've noticed in your sobriety when you started working the steps?
You know, I had to really take a sharp look at myself. I realized that I impacted myself. Like, I impacted other people. Like, I was so used to just thinking that I didn't really have an impact and I'd keep people in the far away. I realized that people might like me and they might want to spend time with me. Like, that terrified me. And once I wasn't so aggressive all the time, because I mean, I was really hostile with people. And once that kind of settled down a bit after doing some step work and realizing that I had some work, that I wasn't always the victim, I had a part to play in this, it made me feel more mature. Like, oh, because if you're always the victim, you've never got a solution, have you? Whereas if you're the one who's causing trouble, that's a solution. It's like, well, then pause, Julie, before you open your mouth. How about walking away? How about doing contrary behavior? Like, that really helped me, the maturity of my relationships, which is probably why I've been able to stay married for 26 years and why I've had long-term sponsees and I've had long-term sponsor. And I'm pretty successful, have my own business, because I've learned that maturity, that other people are as perfectly imperfect as I am. And I always thought that your 100% better look like my 100%. And if it doesn't, I'm going to tell you. And I realized everybody has a different 100%. Everybody's, it looks different. And that has made me, I'm still a bit intense. Like, I'll listen. I'll still go out with my wife and we'll be having dinner with a couple and I'll be getting really intense. And she'll pat me on the leg and I'll go, oh, I'm sorry, am I getting a bit intense, love? She'll go, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's after like 2 hours exercise, prayer, meditation, and me, and I'm still intense. So it just has made me right-sized, the steps. And it's made you human.
Mm. Yeah. So you know we're going to get a question about relationships. Are there any challenges you face being married to someone else in the fellowship? Question. How have you navigated through that? Question.
You know, in it is a good question. And like I said, we have very different, we're very similar programs, but we don't really know the same people. She, my wife, Hilda F., who speaks a lot, she's part of the Pacific group. I'm not. I'm like, no. She loves it. I'm like, hell no, no. She does her own thing, you know. She has her own sponsor, her own sponsee. She has a sponsee meetings, all that business. People don't even know we're together in the fellowship. We had a party, a going away party one time, and they're like, oh, are you? I'm like, this is my wife. Oh, so we're not on top of each other at meetings, not loving on each other. It drives me crazy. When I have sponsees who are in a relationship with somebody else in fellowship, I'm like, you need to sit somewhere and they need to sit somewhere else. You're there for your own recovery and you're there for the newcomer, because a newcomer is not going to come over if you two are hanging on top of each other. How are you going to get some sponsees? How are you going to keep your primary purpose? So I've kept those very separate. And early in our relationship, I shared something about my, something I was struggling at home with my wife. And we got outside and she said to me, I'm really angry you shared that about me. And I said to her, you best go to another meeting then, darling, because I'm going to share what's disturbing me. And right now that's disturbing me. And that was the last time I had to say it to her. You're like, I bet. Because I said it like that too. And also when I had went through a difficult time in our marriage, and I did some behavior that I wasn't very happy with, I was about 9 years, so 10 years sober. I had to give her permission to share it wherever she wanted. I don't get to control what she shares. And we don't get to have a post-mortem. It is lethal if you're in a relationship with somebody to do a post-mortem after it. Do not do that. People have to have the freedom to share in their own group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I had to just move away and realize that I can't control what she shares and she doesn't control what I share. And we've had to learn boundaries. Like she was secretary of the Pacific group. And I could not stand that group. I mean, I love that. I love the group and what it does for her. But for me, I was like angry. And I called my sponsor and I go, oh my God, she just got elected. Because I knew it was going to be a huge commitment for the whole year. It's like that meeting is like 800-900 people a night on a Wednesday night. It's the biggest meeting. And she was secretary. And I was like, oh, I was like, just inconvenient for me. And I called my sponsor. I can't believe this. She just got secretary of the Pacific group on a Wednesday night. And my sponsor goes, oh, what would, I said, I'm really pissed. And my sponsor says, what would God have you be instead? And I was like, oh no, in Brentwood every Wednesday night supporting her for the next year. That's right. So for a year, I went to the Pacific group on Wednesday night. People were nothing but kind to me for the most part for that whole year to support her. So we've navigated through these things. We're not, you know, we get out of each other's way. They say that, don't they? The first sin in AA is to interfere with your own recovery. And the second sin in AA is to interfere with somebody else's. I don't want to interfere with her recovery. She doesn't want it. I told her I was speaking, interrupting her. She's back at work in the morning. I said, oh, babe, I'm sorry. I've got an hour and a half meeting. She's like, it's all right, baby. I'll set you up and I'll go down and gamble and meet you afterwards. I'm like, all right, stay out of trouble. She's like, sad. I don't know what she's been doing. So there's been challenges that we've had to manage. And that group she's part of has a lot of demands, which has been very difficult for me. But I've navigated through them because I love her, and I'd rather her be at meetings and be sane than not at meetings and be insane. That's what comes down to. So I'm like, all right, love you, off you go. Thank you.
Somebody wants to know if your parents stayed married.
They did not. My mother left my father when she was pregnant with her 13th pregnancy. Yes, 13th pregnancy. She left him, and in Ireland, we don't get divorced. At that time, we do now, we didn't then. And I went back and forth to stay with my father at school breaks, three or four times a year. And that was it. When I turned 18, I stopped doing that. So they did not. My mother was always cordial to him. She'd give him some money. He never really had any money. Both of them were alcoholic. And, you know, there was a lot of violence in that marriage, a lot of violence and a lot of abuse. And it was a good thing that they didn't. So I'm glad that they didn't stay together.
I have a question here. Restless, irritable, and discontent in early sobriety. Does it pass and how?
You know, you're not going to like this, but you have to get into action. And it still pops up when I'm off beam, I'm restless, irritable, and discontented, but I know what to do now. I have the solution. And for me, I get myself distracted. I work out. I do prayer meditation. I turn my attention to somebody else. Stop thinking about myself. Did you ever get that feeling? We can't do it now in COVID, but when you're feeling like, God, I don't feel well. I think I've got a headache. God, yeah. Oh, yeah. I think I've got a headache. Oh, yeah. I've got a headache. I feel terrible. And then you have to go out. And when you go out and you connect with everybody, I feel much better after everything. I feel fine. So I've had to get out of myself. I try and call people. But for me, exercise is very, very important. It takes the edge off me. It gets me quiet. I'm able to think after I exercise. It quietens me down. And then I think, what can I do to be useful for somebody else? Like I was wired last Saturday, and I had my best friend, I texted her and was like, hey, I'm up for anything today. I could be talked into anything today. So if you're up for anything, I'm your girl. And she writes like, what? Yeah, get your ass over here. We'll do something. I'm like, all right, thank you. So I try and make myself useful. And I try and know it's me. This is really important. If I'm irritable, restless, and discontented, I want to blame you for that. All of you. I want to go. And, you know, when my wife was living with me, that, you know, that'd be how I'd like, it's definitely her. No, it's not her. If you know you're off, Julie, and you know that because prayer meditation, you know, like, if I don't do prayer meditation, I generally meet like three assholes in about 5 minutes when I leave the house. And I'm like, oh my God, what are the chances of meeting three assholes in 5 minutes? Yeah, what are the chances? Yeah. Oh, it's probably me. So, you know, I've really had to take a hard look at myself and be responsible for myself and not blame people, places, and things when I'm irritable, restless, and discontented, but be helpful, be useful, try to be kind.
Thank you so much. We're at the end of our time. I'll tap you for one quick one. If you have anything you'd like to share about being a member of the home group or your journey in sobriety, being a home group member.
Yeah, I have a home group, that the Sunset Group, on a Thursday night that meets. I'm still on the website for that. And I've been we have real mugs there, and I'm the mug washer upper. The chief mug, I'll tell you, the chief mug washer upper for the last 3 years there. And it, service commitments rotate, and I generally grab newcomers and my sponsees to come and help me. And we have a whole half an hour afterwards to clean up and show up and feel like we're part of something. That was very hard for me because I don't want to have a commitment anywhere. I just want to be free and easy. But I've discovered I needed discipline, and in order to have discipline, I still have three regular meetings that I attend. I generally attend more because I speak or I go and hear other people speaking, but I have three regular meetings that I attend. That, you know, one is an LGBT meeting, which was so hard to go to. I'm like, oh my God. But I've been secretary there, been treasurer there, been secretary again, just finished secretary, I'm treasurer again. So it's like I have that meeting Monday night. I have a speaker meeting that I try and show up, meet up with my sponsees there. And Thursday night, I normally have that meeting that I do that I have commitments at, and that I let my sponsees know, if you want to find me, that's where you're going to find me. I'm always at those meetings. And it's been funny because I work until 7 o'clock at night on a Monday now. And with my wife being away, I kind of get lonely. I live in Angeles National Forest and I get lonely after working all day, being on my own in my own office and I haven't seen anybody really. And I'm working and I put the meeting on, the Monday night meeting, and I drive home with the light on overhead. And I drive home, just listen. I like the comfort. Oh, look, there's John. Oh, look, there's Tim. Oh, look, there's so-and-so. Oh, look, so-and-so speaking tonight. And there's a comfort before I drive into the forest. My drive is like an hour and a quarter. So there's a comfort for me to go to that full meeting and then drive home and I can just get a cup of tea and jump into bed. So those things have been great for me. The discipline of regular meetings where you'll find me regularly and where people know me, good, bad, or indifferent. Thanks.
Ah, wonderful. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank everybody who participated. Julie, that was wonderful. Larry, thank you for wrangling the questions. Everybody will get a chance to thank Julie again after the Lord's Prayer. And if I could ask Ebony to read the last two paragraphs on page 164, please.
Hey, y'all, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ebony. A vision for you from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you, Ebony. Thank you all for a wonderful meeting. And perhaps we could circle up virtually. Have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
Thy kingdom come,
thy will be done
on earth
as it is in heaven.
Give us
this day our daily bread.
And forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Amen.
Thanks, Julie. That was awesome.
Thank you, Julie. That was awesome.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you so much, Julie.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you, ma'am. That was amazing.
Put a stack on black for me.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can go back to camp. And I'm like, oh my God, I've done my responsibility. I can just enjoy myself again.
Right. Good luck, Julie.
Thank you. I'm going to need it.